Chapter 76. That the active intellect is not a separate substance but part of the soul. From the foregoing we may also conclude that neither is there one active intellect in all, as Alexander and Avicenna maintained, who do not hold that there is one possible intellect in all. For since agent and recipient are mutually proportionate, it follows that to every patient there corresponds a proper agent. Now the possible intellect is compared to the active as the proper patient or recipient of the latter, since it is related to it as art to matter, as stated in Frieda Anima. Hence if the possible intellect is part of the human soul, and multiplied according to the number of individuals, as we have shown, the active intellect also will be the like, and not one for all. Again, the active intellect makes the species to be actually intelligible, not that itself may understand by them, especially as a separate substance, since it is not in potentiality, but that the possible intellect may understand by them. Therefore it does not make them to be otherwise than as required by the possible intellect in order that it may understand, but it makes them to be such as it is itself, since every agent produces its like. Therefore the active intellect is proportionate to the possible intellect, and consequently, since the possible intellect is a part of the soul, the active intellect is not a separate substance. Moreover, just as primary matter is perfected by natural forms which are outside the soul, so the possible intellect is perfected by forms actually understood. Now natural forms are received into primary matter, not by the action of only one separate substance, but by the action of a form of the same kind, of a form, namely, that is in matter, even as this particular flesh is begotten through a form that is in this particular flesh and bones, as Aristotle proves in 7 Metaphysics. Consequently, if the possible intellect is a part of the soul and not a separate substance, as we have shown, the active intellect, by whose action the intelligible species result therein, will not be a separate substance, but an active force of the soul. Again, Plato held that knowledge in us is caused by ideas, which he affirmed to be separate substances, and Aristotle refutes this opinion in 1 Metaphysics. Now it is clear that our knowledge depends on the active intellect as its first principle. If, then, the active intellect were a separate substance, there would be little or no difference between this opinion and Plato's, which was refuted by the philosopher. Again, if the active intellect be a separate substance, its action must needs be continuous and uninterrupted, or at least we must say that it is not continued or interrupted at our will. Now its action is to make phantasms actually intelligible. Either, therefore, it will do this always, or not always. If not always, this will nevertheless not be at our discretion. Now, we understand actually when the phantasms are made actually intelligible. Consequently, it follows that either we always understand, or that it is not in our power to understand actually. Further, a separate substance stands in the same relation to all the phantasms that are in any man whatsoever, even as the sun stands in the same relation to all colors. Now sensible things are perceived by those who know as well as by those who are ignorant, and consequently the same phantasms are in both. Hence they will be made intelligible by the active intellect in either case, and consequently both will equally understand. It may be said, however, that the active intellect for its own part is always active, but that the phantasms are not always made actually intelligible, but only when they are disposed thereto. Now, they are disposed thereto by the act of the cogitative power, the use of which is in our power. Consequently, to understand actually is in our power. It is for this reason that not all men understand the things whereof they have the phantasms, since not all have the requisite act of the cogitative power, but only those who are instructed and accustomed. Nevertheless, this reply is seemingly not quite sufficient. For this disposition to understand, which is effected by the cogitative power, must either be a disposition of the possible intellect to receive intelligible forms emanating from the active intellect, as Avicenna maintains, or a disposition of the phantasms to be made actually intelligible, as Averroes and Alexander assert. Now, the former would seem improbable, because the possible intellect by its very nature is in potentiality with regard to species actually intelligible, wherefore it stands in the same relation to them as a transparent body to light or to colored images. And if a thing by its very nature is capable of receiving a certain form, it needs no further disposition to that form, unless perchance it contain contrary dispositions, As the matter of water is disposed to the form of air by the removal of cold and density. But there is nothing contrary in the possible intellect to prevent it receiving any intelligible species whatsoever, since the intelligible species even of contraries are not themselves contrary in the intellect, as Aristotle proves in 7 Metaphysics. For one is the reason for knowing the other, and the falsity which is incidental to the intellect's judgment in composition and division, results not from the presence in the intellect of certain things understood, but from its lack of certain things. Therefore the possible intellect, for its own part, requires no preparation in order to receive the intelligible species emanating from the active intellect. Further, colors which light has made actually visible, without fail impress their likeness on the diaphanous body and consequently on the sight. Consequently, if the phantasms themselves on which the active intellect has shed its light did not impress their likeness on the possible intellect, but merely disposed it to receive them, the phantasms would not stand in the same relation to the possible intellect as colors to the sight, as Aristotle asserts. Again, according to this, the phantasms, and consequently the senses, would not be of themselves necessary for us to understand, but only accidentally, as it were inciting and preparing the possible intellect to receive. This is part of the Platonist theory, and contrary to the order which Aristotle assigns to the generation of art and science, in the first book of Metaphysics, and the last book of Posterior Analytics, where he says that memory results from sensation, experience from many memories, from many memories the universal apprehension which is the beginning of science and art. This opinion of Avicenna, however, is in keeping with what he says about the generation of natural things. For he holds that all lower agents, by their actions, prepare matter to receive the forms which emanate from a separate active intelligence into their respective matters. Hence also, for the same reason, he holds that the phantasms prepare the possible intellect, and that the intelligible forms emanate from a separate substance. In like manner, if it be supposed that the active intellect is a separate substance, it seems unreasonable that the phantasms should be prepared by the cogitative power in order that they be actually intelligible and move the possible intellect. For this is seemingly in keeping with the opinion of those who say that the lower agents merely dispose to the ultimate perfection, and that this ultimate perfection is caused by a separate agent, which is contrary to the opinion of Aristotle in 7 Metaphysics. For it would seem that the human soul is not less perfectly equipped for understanding than the lower things of nature for their proper operations. Moreover, in this lower world the more noble effects are produced not by higher agents alone, but also require agents of their own genus, for the sun and man generate a man. In like manner we observe that in other perfect animals, some of the lower animals are generated by the mere action of the sun, without an active principle of their own genus, for instance animals engendered of putrefaction. Now understanding is the most noble effect that takes place in this lower world. Therefore it is not enough to ascribe it to a remote agent, unless we suppose it to have also a proximate cause. This argument however does not avail against Avicenna, because he holds that any animal can be generated without seed. Again, the intention of the effect shows the agent. Wherefore animals engendered of putrefaction are not intended by a lower nature but only by a higher, since they are produced by a higher nature, only for which reason Aristotle 7 Metaphysics says that they are effects of chance. Whereas animals that are produced from seed are intended both by the higher and the lower nature. But this effect, which is to abstract universal forms from the phantasms, is in our intention, and not merely in the intention of the remote agent. Therefore it follows that in us there must be a proximate principle of such an effect, and this is the active intellect. Therefore it is not a separate substance, but a power of our soul. Again, the nature of every mover includes a principle sufficient for the natural operation thereof, and if this operation consists in an action, that nature includes an active principle, as appears in the powers of the nutritive soul of plants, while if this operation is a passion, it includes a passive principle, as appears in the sensitive powers of animals. Now man is the most perfect of all lower movers, and his proper and natural operation is to understand, which is not completed without some passion, in so far as the intellect is passive to the intelligible, nor again without action, insofar as the intellect makes things that are potentially intelligible to be intelligible actually. Therefore the respective principles of both, namely the active and possible intellects, must be in man's nature, and neither of these must be separate, as to its being, from the soul of man. Again, if the active intellect be a separate substance, it is evident that it is above man's nature. Now an operation which man performs by the power alone of a higher substance is a supernatural operation, such as the working of miracles, prophesying, and other like things which men do by God's favor. Since, then, man cannot understand except by the power of the active intellect, if the active intellect be a separate substance, it will follow that intelligence is not a natural operation to man, and consequently man cannot be defined as being intellectual and rational. Further, nothing operates save by a power that is in it formally, wherefore rerum totum tot de anima proves that the thing whereby we live and sense is a form and an act. Now both actions, namely of the active and possible intellects, are competent to man, for man abstracts from phantasms, and receives in his mind actual intelligibles, since otherwise we should not have become cognizant of these actions unless we experienced them in ourselves. Therefore the principles to which these actions are ascribed, namely the possible and active intellects, must be powers formally existing in us. If, however, it be said that these actions are ascribed to man insofar as the aforesaid intellects are in conjunction with us, as Averroes says, it has already been shown, that the possible intellect's conjunction with us, if it be a separate substance, such as he holds it to be, does not suffice for us to understand by its means. The same evidently applies to the active intellect, for the active intellect is to the intelligible species that art received into the possible intellect, as art to the artificial forms which art produces in matter, as appears from the example given by Aristotle in Three de Anima. Now art forms do not acquire the action of art, but only a formal likeness, so that neither can the subject of these forms exercise the action of the craftsman. Therefore neither can man exercise the operation of the active intellect, through the intelligible species being made actual in him by the active intellect. Again, a thing that cannot set about its proper operation unless it be moved by an outward principle, is moved to operate rather than moves itself. Wherefore irrational animals are moved to operate rather than move themselves, since their every operation depends on the outward principle which moves them, for their sense, moved by the outward sensible, makes an impression on their imagination, and thus there is an orderly process in all their powers down to the motive powers. Now man's proper operation is intelligence, the first principle whereof is the active intellect which produces the intelligible species, to which in a sense the possible intellect is passive, and this being made actual moves the will. If, then, the active intellect is a substance outside man, all man's operation depends on an outward principle, and consequently he will not move himself but will be moved by another. Hence he will not be the master of his own operations, nor will he be deserving of praise or blame, and there will be an end to all moral science and social intercourse, which is absurd. Therefore the active intellect is not a substance separate from man. Chapter 77. That it is not impossible for the possible and active intellect to concur in the one substance of the soul. Perhaps it will seem impossible to someone that one and the same substance, namely, that of our soul, should be in potentiality to all intelligibles, which belongs to the possible intellect, and should make them actual, which belongs to the active intellect, since a thing acts not as it is in potentiality, but as it is in act. Wherefore it does not appear how the active and possible intellect can concur in the one substance of the soul. If, however, one look into the matter rightly, nothing impossible or difficult follows, for nothing hinders one thing from being in one respect in potentiality with regard to some other thing, and in act in another respect, as we observe in natural things, for air is actually damp and potentially dry, whereas with earth it is the other way about. Now we find this same comparison between the intellective soul and the phantasms. For the soul has something in act to which the phantasm is in potentiality, and is in potentiality to something which is found actually in the phantasms, because the substance of the human soul has immateriality, and, as is evident from what has been said, consequently has an intellectual nature, since such is every immaterial substance. Yet it does not follow that it is likened to this or that determinate thing, which is required in order that our soul may know this or that thing determinately, for all knowledge results from the likeness of the known in the knower. Hence the intellective soul remains itself in potentiality to the determinate likenesses of things that can be known by us, and these are the natures of sensible things. It is the phantasms that offer us these determinate natures of sensible things, which phantasms, however, have not yet acquired intelligible being, since they are images of sensible things even as to material conditions, which are the individual properties, and moreover are in material organs. Wherefore they are not actually intelligible. And yet, since in the individual man whose image the phantasms reflect, it is possible to conceive the universal nature apart from all the individualizing conditions, they are intelligible potentially. Accordingly they have intelligibility potentially, though they are actually determinate as images of things, whereas it was the other way about in the intellective soul. Consequently there is in the intellective soul an active power in respect of the phantasms, rendering them actually intelligible, and this power of the soul is called the active intellect. There is also in the soul a power that is in potentiality to the determinate images of sensible things, and this is the power of the possible intellect. Nevertheless, that which is found in the soul differs from what is found in natural agents, because in the latter one thing is in potentiality to something according to the same mode as it is actually found in another, for the matter of the air is in potentiality to the form of water in the same way as it is in water. Hence natural bodies which have a common matter are mutually active and passive in the same order, whereas the intellective soul is not in potentiality to the likenesses of things which are in the phantasms, according to the mode in which they are there, but according as these images are raised to something higher, by being abstracted from the individualizing conditions of matter, so that they become actually intelligible. Consequently the action of the active intellect on the phantasm precedes the reception by the possible intellect. Wherefore the preeminence of the action is ascribed, not to the phantasms but to the active intellect. For this reason Aristotle says, that it is compared to the possible intellect as art to matter. We should have a perfect example of this if the eye, besides being a diaphanous body and receptive of colors, had sufficient light to make colors actually visible, even as certain animals are said to throw sufficient light on objects by the light of their eyes, for which reason they see more by night and less by day, because their eyes are weak, since they are moved by a dim and confused by a strong light. There is something like this in our intellect, for as much as with regard to things most manifest it is as the eye of the owl with regard to the sun, so that the little intellectual light which is connatural to us is sufficient for our act of intelligence. It is clear that the intellectual light connatural to our soul suffices to cause the action of the active intellect, if we consider why it is necessary to place an active intellect in the soul. For the soul was found to be in potentiality to intelligibles, as the senses to sensibles, since just as we do not always sense, so neither do we always understand. Now these intelligibles which the human intellective soul understands were asserted by Plato to be intelligible of themselves, namely ideas. Wherefore it was unnecessary for him to admit an active intelligence in respect of intelligibles. But if this were true, it would follow that the more things are intelligible of themselves, the more would they be understood by us. Yet this is clearly false, because the nearer things are to our senses, the more intelligible are they to us, though in themselves they are less intelligible. Consequently Aristotle was moved to assert that those things which are intelligible to us, are not certain things that are intelligibles in themselves, but that they are made intelligible from sensibles. Hence he had to place a power which would do this, and this is the active intellect. Wherefore the reason for placing the active intellect is that it may make intelligibles proportionate to us. Now this does not exceed the mode of the intellectual light connatural to us. Therefore nothing hinders us from ascribing the action of the active intellect to the light of our soul, and especially since Aristotle compares the active intellect to a light. Chapter 78. That Aristotle's opinion concerning the active intellect was not that it is a separate substance, but rather that it is part of the soul. Since however some agree with the above opinion, in the belief that it reflects the mind of Aristotle, we must show from his words that in his opinion the active intellect is not a separate substance. For he says, in the first place, that just as in every nature there is something like the matter in every genus, which is in potentiality to all that comes under that genus, While there is also a cause like the efficient cause, as art in relation to matter, so must these differences be in the soul. The latter, namely that which is as matter in the soul, is the possible intellect wherein all things intelligible are made, whereas the former, which is as the efficient cause in the soul, is the intellect by which we make all things namely actually intelligible, and this is the active intellect, which is like a habit, and not a power. In what sense he calls the active intellect a habit, he explains by adding that it is as a light, since in a manner light makes potential colors to be colors actually, in so far, to wit, as it makes them to be actually visible, because this is what is ascribed to the active intellect in regard to intelligibles. From this we gather that the active intellect is not a separate substance but rather a part of the soul, for he says explicitly that the possible and active intellect are differences of the soul and that they are in the soul. Therefore neither of them is a separate substance. Again, his argument proves this also, because in every nature wherein we find potentiality and act, there is something by way of matter that is in potentiality to the things of that genus, and something by way of agent, that reduces the potentiality to act, even as in the products of art, there is art and matter. Now the intellective soul is a nature in which we find potentiality and act, since sometimes it is actually understanding and sometimes potentially. Therefore in the nature of the intellective soul there is something by way of matter, that is in potentiality to all intelligibles, and this is called the possible intellect, and there is something by way of efficient cause which makes all things actual and is called the active intellect. Consequently both intellects, according to the argument of Aristotle, are in the nature of the soul, and are not something separate as to being from the body of which the soul is the act. Moreover, Aristotle says that the active intellect is like a habit that is a light. Now a habit does not designate something existing by itself, but something belonging to one who has it habentis. Therefore the active intellect is not a substance existing separately by itself, but is part of the human soul. The text of Aristotle, however, does not mean that the effect of the active intellect may be described as a habit, as though the sense where the active intellect makes man to understand all things, which is like a habit. For the meaning of habit, as the commentator of Rose says on this very passage, is that he who has the habit understands by that which is proper to him, by himself, and whenever he will, without any need therein of something extrinsic, since he explicitly likens to a habit, not the effect itself, but the intellect by which we make all things. And yet we are not to understand that the active intellect is a habit in the same way as a habit is in the second species of quality, in which sense some have said that the active intellect is the habit of principles, because this habit of principles is derived from sensibles, as Aristotle proves to Poster, and consequently, it must needs be the effect of the active intellect, to which it belongs to make actually intelligible the phantasms that are understood potentially. But habit is to be taken as contrasted with privation and potentiality, in which sense every form and act may be called a habit. This is evident, since he asserts that the active intellect is a habit in the same way as light is a habit. After this he adds that this, namely the active intellect, is separate, unmixed, impassible, and an actually existing substance. Now of these four conditions which he ascribes to the active intellect, he had already explicitly ascribed it to the possible intellect, namely that it is unmixed and separate. He had applied the third, that it is impassible, with a distinction, for he proves in the first place that it is not passible as the senses are, and afterwards he shows that, taking passion broadly, it is passive in so far as it is in potentiality to intelligibles. But as to the fourth, he absolutely denies it of the possible intellect, and says that it was in potentiality to intelligibles, and none of these things was actual before the act of intelligence. Accordingly in the first to the possible intellect agrees with the active, in the third it agrees partly, and partly differs, while in the fourth the active differs altogether from the possible intellect. He proves these four conditions of the active intellect by one argument, when he goes on to say, for the agent is always more noble than the patient, and the active principle than matter. For he had said above that the active intellect is like an efficient cause, and the possible intellect like matter. Now by this middle proposition the two first conditions are proved. Thus the agent is more noble than the patient and matter. But the possible intellect, which is as patient and matter, is separate and untrammeled, as proved above, much more therefore is the agent. The others are proved by this middle proposition, thus the agent is more noble than the patient and matter, in that it is compared thereto as agent and actual being to patient and potential being. Now, the possible intellect is, in a sense, patient and potential being. Therefore the active intellect is a non-passive agent and an actual being. And it is evident that neither from these words of Aristotle can we gather that the active intellect is a separate substance, but that it is separate in the same sense as he had already said of the possible intellect, namely as not having an organ. When he says that it is an actually existing substance, his is not inconsistent with the substance of the soul being in potentiality, as we have shown above. Then he goes on to say, now knowledge when actual is identical with a thing, where the commentator says that the active intellect differs from the possible, because that which understands and that which is understood are the same in the active, but not in the possible intellect. But this is clearly contrary to the meaning of Aristotle, for he had employed the same words before, in speaking of the possible intellect, where he says of the possible intellect that it is intelligible as intelligibles are, since in things void of matter, understanding and that which is understood are the same, because speculative knowledge is identified with that which it speculates. For he clearly wishes to show that the possible intellect is understood like other intelligibles, from the fact that the possible intellect, as understanding actually, is the same as that which is understood. Moreover he had said a little earlier, that, in a manner, the possible intellect is potentially the intelligibles, but is nothing actually before it understands, where he clearly gives one to understand that by understanding actually it becomes the intelligibles. Nor is it surprising that he should say this of the possible intellect, since he had already said this of sense and the sensible in act, for the sense becomes actual by the species actually sensed, and in like manner the possible intellect becomes actual by the intelligible species in act. And for this reason the intellect in act is said to be the intelligible itself in act. Accordingly we must say that Aristotle, after defining the possible and active intellects, begins here to describe the intellect in act, when he says that actual knowledge is the same as the thing actually known. Afterwards he says, but that which is in potentiality, in point of time, proceeds in one subject, but not altogether in point of time. Which distinction between potentiality and act is employed by him in several places, namely that act is naturally prior to potentiality, but that in point of time, potentiality precedes act in one and the same subject that is changed from potentiality to act, and yet that absolutely speaking potentiality does not precede act even in point of time, since potentiality is not reduced to act except by an act. He says, therefore, that the intellect which is in potentiality, namely the possible intellect considered as being in potentiality, precedes the intellect in act in point of time, and this, be it said, in one and the same subject, but not altogether. I.e., universally, because the possible intellect is reduced to act by the active intellect, which again is in act, as he said, by some possible intellect made actual. Wherefore he said that before learning a man needs a teacher to reduce him from potentiality to act. Accordingly in these words he shows the relation of the possible intellect, as in potentiality, to the intellect in act. Then he says, but it does not sometimes understand, and sometimes not understand, whereby he indicates the difference between the intellect in act and the possible intellect. For he said above, the possible intellect that it does not understand always, but sometimes does not understand, when it is in potentiality to intelligibles, and sometimes understands, when, to wit, it is them actually. Now the intellect becomes actual by becoming the intelligibles, as he had already stated. Consequently it is not competent to it to understand sometimes, and sometimes not to understand. Afterwards, he adds, but that alone is separate which is intellect truly. This cannot apply to the active intellect, since it alone is not separate, for he had already said the same of the possible intellect. Nor can it apply to the possible intellect, since he had already said this of the active intellect. It follows, then, that it is said of that which includes both, namely the intellect in act, of which he was speaking, because this alone in our soul is separate and uses no organ, which belongs to the intellect in act, namely that part of the soul whereby we understand actually and which includes both the possible and active intellect. Wherefore he adds that only this part of the soul is immortal and everlasting, as being independent of the body, through being separate therefrom. Chapter 79. That the human soul is not corrupted when the body is corrupted. From the foregoing, then, we can clearly show that the human soul is not corrupted when the body is corrupted. For it was proved above, that every intellectual substance is incorruptible. Now man's soul is an intellectual substance, as we have proved. Therefore it follows that the human soul is incorruptible. Again, nothing is corrupted on account of that wherein its perfection consists, for these changes are contrary to one another, those namely which tend to perfection and corruption. Now the perfection of the human soul consists in a certain abstraction from the body, for the soul is perfected by knowledge and virtue, and as to knowledge it is perfected the more it considers immaterial things, while the perfection of virtue consists in man not following the passions of the body, but tempering and curbing them according to reason. Therefore the soul is not corrupted through being separated from the body. If, however, it be said that the soul's perfection consists in its being separated from the body as regards operation, and its corruption, in its being separated as regards being, this reply is not to the point, because a thing's operation points to its substance and being, since a thing acts according as it is a being, and a thing's proper operation follows its proper nature. Wherefore the operation of a thing cannot be perfected except in so far as that thing's substance is perfected. Hence if the soul is perfected, as to its operation, in quitting the body, its incorporeal substance will not fail in its being, through being separated from the body. Again, that which properly perfects man in his soul is something incorruptible, because the proper operation of man, as man, is to understand, since it is in this that he differs from brutes, plants, and inanimate things. Now the object of the act of understanding is properly the universal and the incorruptible as such, and perfection should be proportionate to the perfectible. Therefore the human soul is incorruptible. Moreover, the natural appetite cannot possibly be frustrated. Now man naturally desires to exist always, which is evidenced by the fact that being is that which all things desire, and man by his intellect apprehends being not merely as now, as dumb animals do, but simply. Therefore man acquires perpetuity in regard to his soul, which apprehends being simply and for all time. Again, whatever is received in a thing is received therein according to the mode of that in which it is. Now the forms of things are received in the possible intellect according as they are actually intelligible, and they are actually intelligible according as they are immaterial, universal, and consequently incorruptible. Therefore the possible intellect is incorruptible. But, as we proved above, the possible intellect is part of the human soul. Therefore the human soul is incorruptible. Again, intelligible being is more lasting than sensible being. Now in sensible things that which is by way of first recipient, namely primary matter, is incorruptible as to its substance. Much more so therefore is the possible intellect, which is the recipient of intelligible forms. Therefore the human soul also, whereof the intellect is a part, is incorruptible. Moreover, the maker is more noble than the thing made, as also Aristotle says. But the active intellect makes things actually intelligible, as shown above. Since, then, things actually intelligible, as such, are incorruptible, much more will the active intellect be incorruptible. Therefore such is also the soul, the light of which is the active intellect, as appears from what has been already stated. Again, no form is corrupted except either by the action of its contrary, or by the corruption of its subject, or by the failing of its cause by the action of its contrary, as heat is destroyed by the action of cold, by the corruption of its subject, as the faculty of sight is destroyed through the destruction of the eye and by the failing of its cause, as the light of the air fails through the sun, which was its cause, failing to be present. But the human soul cannot be destroyed by the action of a contrary, for nothing is contrary thereto, since by the possible intellect it is cognizant and receptive of all contraries. Likewise it cannot be corrupted through the corruption of its subject, for it has been proved above, that the human soul is a form independent of the body as to its being. Moreover it cannot be destroyed through the failing of its cause, since it can have none but an eternal cause, as we shall show further on. The human soul can noways be corrupted. Again, if the soul be corrupted through the corruption of the body, it follows that its being is weakened through the body being weakened. Now if a power of the soul is weakened through the weakening of the body, this is only accidental, insofar, to wit, as the power of the soul needs a bodily organ, thus the sight is weakened, accidentally however, through the weakening of the organ. This is made clear as follows. If some weakness were essentially attached to the power, the latter would never be repaired through the organ being repaired. Yet we see that, however much the power of sight may seem to be weakened, if the organ be repaired, the sight is repaired. Wherefore Aristotle says wonder anima, that if an old man were to be given the eye of a young man, he would certainly see as well as a young man does. Accordingly, since the intellect is a power of the soul that needs no organ, as shown above, 610, it is not weakened, either essentially or accidentally, by old age or any other bodily weakness. If, on the other hand, the operation of the intellect happened to be affected by fatigue or some hindrance on account of the weakness of the body, this is owing not to weakness of the intellect itself, but to the weakness of the powers which the intellect needs, namely of the imagination, memory, and cogitative power. It is therefore clear that the intellect is incorruptible. Consequently, the human soul is also, since it is an intellective substance. This is also proved from the authority of Aristotle, for he says, that the intellect is clearly a substance and incorruptible, and it may be gathered from what has been already said, that this cannot refer to a separate substance that is either the possible or the active intellect. It also follows from the very words of Aristotle, he says, speaking against Plato, that moving causes pre-exist, whereas formal causes are simultaneous with the things whereof they are causes. For when a man is healed, then is the health, and not before, against Plato's statement that the forms of things exist before the things themselves. And, after saying this, he goes on to say as to whether anything remains afterwards, this must be inquired into. For in some this is not impossible. For example, if the soul be of a certain kind, not of any kind, but if it be intellectual, from which it is clear, since he is speaking of forms, that he means that the intellect which is the form of man, remains, after the matter, namely after the body. It is also clear from the foregoing words of Aristotle that, although he states the soul to be a form, he does not assert it to be non-subsistent and therefore corruptible, as Gregory of Nyssa would have him mean, since he excludes the intellective soul from the generality of other forms, by saying that it remains after the soul, and that it is a substance. The teaching of the Catholic faith is in keeping with the foregoing, for it is said in the book De Ecclesiastici Dogmatibus, believe that man alone has a subsistent soul, which survives even after it has put off the body, and is the life-giving source of the senses and faculties. Neither does it die when the body dies, as the Arabian asserts, nor after a short interval of time, as Zeno pretends, because it is a living substance. Hereby is set aside the error of the ungodly, in whose person Solomon says, Wisdom 2:2, we are born of nothing, and after this we shall be as if we had not been, and in whose person Solomon says, the death of man and of beasts is one, and the condition of them both is equal. As man dieth, so they also die. All things breathe alike, and man hath nothing more than beast. For it is clear that he speaks not in his own person but in that of the ungodly, since at the end of the book, he says as though deciding the point before, the dust return into its earth from whence it was, and the spirit return to him who gave it. Moreover, there are innumerable passages of Holy Writ that declare the immortality of the soul. Chapters 80 and 81. Arguments to prove that the soul is corrupted when the body is corrupted. Certain arguments would seem to show that human souls cannot possibly remain after the body, for if human souls are multiplied according to the multiplication of bodies, as we have proved above, it follows that when the bodies are destroyed, the souls cannot remain in their multitude. Wherefore one of two alternatives must follow: either that the human soul altogether ceases to exist, or that only one remains. And this would seem to concur with the opinion of those who state that only that which is one in all men is incorruptible, whether this be the active intellect alone, as Alexander says, or the possible besides the active intellect, according to Averroes. Moreover, the formal ratio is the cause of specific difference. Now, if many souls remain after the corruption of bodies, They must differ from each other because, as there is identity where there is oneness of substance, so is there difference where there are many in substance. But in souls that survive bodies there can be no difference other than formal, since they are not composed of matter and form, as we have proved above, of every intellectual substance. Hence it follows that they differ specifically. And yet souls are not changed to another species by the corruption of the body, since whatever is changed from species to species is corrupted. It follows therefore that even before they were separated from their bodies, they were different in species. Now composites derive their species from their form. Consequently individual men will differ specifically, which is absurd. Therefore it is seemingly impossible that many souls should survive their bodies. Again, according to those who hold the eternity of the world, it would seem altogether impossible to maintain that human souls remain in their multitude after the death of the body. For if the world exists from eternity, movement is from eternity and consequently generation also is eternal. But if generation be eternal, an infinite number of men have died before us. Consequently, if the souls of the dead remain in their multitude after death, we must say that there is actually an infinite number of souls of men already dead. But this is impossible since the actually infinite cannot exist in nature. Therefore it follows, if the world is eternal, that souls do not remain many after death. Again, that which accrues to a thing and departs from it without the latter being corrupted, accrues to it accidentally, or this is the definition of an accident. Hence if the soul be not corrupted when parted from the body, it would follow that the soul is united to the body accidentally. Consequently man is an accidental being, composed of soul and body. And it will follow moreover that there is no human species, since one species does not result from things united accidentally. For white man is not a species. Moreover, there cannot possibly be a substance that has no operation. Now all operation of the soul ends with the body, which is proved by induction. For the nutritive powers of the soul operate through the bodily qualities, and through a bodily instrument, and act on the body which is perfected by the soul, is nourished and increased, and from which is severed the seed for the purpose of generation. Again, all the operations of the powers belonging to the sensitive soul are accomplished through bodily organs, some of them being accomplished with a certain bodily transmutation. For instance, those which are called passions of the soul, such as love, joy, and the like. Moreover, though understanding is not an operation fulfilled through a bodily organ, yet its objects are the phantasms which stand in relation to it, as colors to the sight. Wherefore, as the sight cannot see without colors, so the intellective soul cannot understand without phantasms. Further, the soul, in order to understand, needs the powers which prepare the phantasms so as to make them actually intelligible, namely the cogitative power and the memory, which clearly cannot remain after the body, since they are acts of certain organs of the body, and operate through those organs. Hence Aristotle says that the soul does not understand without phantasms, and that it understands nothing without the passive intellect, which he calls the cogitative power, and which is corruptible. For this reason he says, that man's act of understanding is corrupted when something within him is corrupted, namely the phantasm or the passive intellect. And it is stated in 3 De Anima, that after death we do not remember what we knew in life. It is accordingly evident that no operation of the soul can remain after death. Therefore neither does its substance remain, since no substance can be without operation. Now, since these arguments lead to a false conclusion, as was shown above, we must endeavor to answer them. And, in the first place, it must be observed that whatever things have to be adapted and proportionate to one another, are together multiplied or unified, each by its own cause. Wherefore if the being of one depends on the other, its unity or multiplicity depends also thereon. Otherwise it depends on some other extrinsic cause. Now form and matter need always to be mutually proportionate and naturally adapted, so to speak, because the proper act is produced in its proper matter. Consequently matter and form must always agree in point of multitude and unity. Hence if the being of the form depend on matter, its multiplication, as also its unity, depends on matter. But if not, the form must needs be multiplied according to the multiplication of the matter, that is together with matter, and in proportion thereto, yet not so that the unity or multiplicity of the very form depend on matter. Now it has been shown, that the human soul is a form independent of matter as to its being. Wherefore it follows that souls are indeed multiplied according as bodies are multiplied, and yet the multiplication of bodies is not the cause of the multiplication of souls. Therefore it does not follow that the plurality of souls ceases with the destruction of bodies, as the first argument concluded. From this the reply also to the second argument is clear, for it is not every difference of forms that causes a difference of species, but only that which is in respect of formal principles, or of a different kind of form, since it is clear that the form is essentially distinct in this and that fire, and yet neither fire nor form is specifically different. Accordingly multitude of souls separated from their bodies results from the substantial distinction of forms, since one soul is substantially distinct from another, and yet this distinction does not result from a distinction in the essential principles of the soul, nor from a different kind of soul, but from the various company adaptation of souls to bodies, because this soul is adapted to this and not to that body, and that soul to another body, and so on. And this company adaptation remains in the soul even after the body has perished, even as the soul's substance remains through being independent of the body in the point of being. For the soul according to its substance is the form of the body, else it would be united to the body accidentally, and consequently the union of body and soul would result in one thing not essentially but accidentally. Now it is as forms that souls need to be adapted to their bodies. Therefore it is clear that these same various coptations remain in separated souls, and consequently the plurality of souls remains also. The third argument given above has been the occasion for some who held the world to be eternal, to fall into various strange opinions. For some granted the conclusion absolutely, and said that human souls perish altogether with their bodies. Others said that of all souls there remains some one thing separate that is common to all, namely the active intellect according to some, or besides this the possible intellect, according to others. Others however held that souls remain in their multitude after bodies, but lest they should be compelled to admit an infinite number of souls, they said that the same souls are united to different bodies after a certain time. This was the Platonists' opinion, of which we shall treat further on. Others again, avoiding all the above statements, said that it is not impossible for separate souls to be actually infinite in number, because in things not ordered to each other to be actually infinite is to be infinite accidentally, and they hold that there is no reason not to admit this. This is the opinion of Avicenna and Algazel. We do not find it expressly stated by Aristotle to which of these opinions he adhered, although he holds explicitly the eternity of the world. The last however of the above opinions is not inconsistent with the principles laid down by him. For in 3 Physics, and 1 Col. Edmund, he proves that the actually infinite is impossible in natural bodies, but not in immaterial substances. Nevertheless it is certain that this question offers no difficulty to those who profess the Catholic faith, since they do not admit the world to be eternal. Again, if the soul remain after the destruction of the body, it does not follow that it must have been accidentally united to it, as the fourth argument concluded. For an accident is described as that which may be present or absent without the corruption of the subject composed of matter and form. Now, if this be referred to the principles of the composite subject, it is found to be untrue. For it is clear that primary matter is not subject to generation and corruption, as Aristotle proves, wherefore it remains in its essence when the form departs. And yet the form was united to it not accidentally but essentially, since it was united to it in one being. Likewise the soul is united to the body in one being, as we proved above. Wherefore, though it survive the body, it is united to it essentially and not accidentally. That primary matter does not remain actually after the form except in respect of the act of another form, whereas that the human soul remains in the same act, is due to the fact that the human soul is form and act, whereas primary matter is a being in potentiality. As to the statement put forward in the fifth argument, that no operation can remain in the soul when separated from the body, we say that it is false, since those operations remain which are not exercised through organs, such as to understand and to will. But those operations do not remain which are performed through bodily organs, such as the operations of the nutritive and sensitive powers. It must be observed, however, that the soul understands in a different way when separated from the body and when united to it, even as it has a different mode of existence because a thing acts according as it is. For although the being of the soul, while united to the body, is absolute and independent of the body, nevertheless the body is the lodging as it were and the subject that receives it. Wherefore in consequence its proper operation, which is to understand, though not depending on the body as though it were performed through a bodily organ, has its object in the body, namely the phantasms. Hence, as long as the soul is in the body, it cannot understand without a phantasm, neither can it remember except through the powers of cogitation and memory, by which the phantasms are prepared, as stated above. For this reason understanding, as regards this mode, as also remembering, is destroyed when the body perishes. On the other hand, the separated soul has its being apart from the body. Wherefore neither will its operation, which is to understand, be performed in dependence upon certain objects existing in bodily organs, which are the phantasms, but it will understand by itself after the manner of substances wholly separate from bodies as to their being, of which we shall speak further on. From which substances, moreover, as from things higher than itself, it will be able to receive a more abundant inflow so as to understand more perfectly. We have a sign of this in the young. For the soul, the more it is withdrawn from being occupied about its own body, is rendered more apt to understand certain higher things. Wherefore the virtue of temperance, which withdraws the soul from bodily pleasures, above all makes men apt in understanding. Moreover, men while asleep and not using their bodily senses, and when there is no disturbance of the humors or vapors to hinder them, are influenced by higher beings so as to perceive certain future things that surpass the purview of human reasoning. And this is much more the case with those who are in a faint or an ecstasy, forasmuch as they are the more withdrawn from the senses of the body. Nor does this happen unreasonably because, since the human soul, as shown above, is on the boundary line of corporeal and incorporeal substances, as though it were on the horizon of eternity and time, by withdrawing from the lower world it approaches to the higher. Wherefore when it shall be wholly separated from the body, it will be perfectly likened to separate substances as to the manner of understanding and will receive their influence abundantly. Accordingly, though our act of understanding as regards its mode in the present life ceases when the body perishes, another and higher mode of understanding will take its place. Remembrance, however, since it is an act performed through a bodily organ, as Aristotle proves in his book De Memoria et Reminiscentia, remain in the soul after the body, unless remembrance be taken equivocally for the understanding of those things which the soul knew before. For the soul must needs remember what it knew in life, since the intelligible species are received indelibly into the possible intellect, as we have shown above. With regard to the other operations of the soul, such as to love, to rejoice, and the like, we must beware of equivocation, because sometimes they are taken for passions of the soul, and thus they are acts of the sensible appetite in respect of the irascible and concupiscible faculties, together with a certain bodily transmutation, and thus they cannot remain in the soul after death, as Aristotle proves in his book De Anima. But sometimes they are taken for a simple act of the will, that is without any passion. Wherefore Aristotle says in the seventh book of Ethics that God rejoices by one simple operation, and in the tenth book, that in the contemplation of wisdom there is wonderful pleasure, and in the eighth book, he distinguishes the love of friendship from the love that is a passion. Now since the will is a power that uses no organ, as neither does the intellect, it is clear that these things, in so far as they are acts of the will, remain in the separated soul. Hence it cannot be concluded from the foregoing arguments that man's soul is mortal. Dash.